thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Before we begin this week's episode, I want to share a book I recently finished by Kensington Publishing. American Fly Girl by Susan Tate Ankeny chronicles the amazing true story of Hazel Ying Lee, an unrecognized pioneer and unsung World War II hero who fought for a country that discriminated against her gender, race, and ambition. Inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Hazel was the first Chinese-American woman in U.S. history to earn a pilot's license and fly for the military as a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Now, I'd heard of the WASPs, but really knew nothing about them or their incredible stories until reading this book. American Fly Girl, the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, who followed her dreams against all the odds and became an American hero, is written by Susan Tate Ankeny and goes on sale April 23rd, 2024, wherever fine books are sold.
We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan. You're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know anything more than that.
Okay, now I got an aircraft 6 miles east of the White House.
He's rocking back and forth.
We're 5-6-8-6-5. I advise you stay away from that aircraft. Go north as fast as you can.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land?
He did not land. Land.
There are days in our lives that forever change us, whether as individuals or as nations. The tragic events of Tuesday, September 11, 2001, a day when terrorists used commercial airliners as weapons to attack our financial and government facilities, killing thousands of civilians, is such a day. And we will never forget.
None of us will ever forget this day. Yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world.
Hello, my name is Vincent Aiello. I am the founder and host of the Fighter Pilot Podcast, and I recently had the opportunity to chat with Martin Richard, a now retired Massachusetts Air National Guard F-15 Eagle pilot who was airborne on 9/11/01. I hope our discussion sheds light on the military aviation response to the events of that day, and that you are reminded of the sacrifices made by so many on that day and in the many days since.
These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve.
All right, Martin, I don't know about you, but I can barely remember what I had for dinner last night or the night before, but this is September, and every September we think about events on 9/11/01, and I bet you can remember that day, can't you?
Yeah, I sure can. Like yesterday, for sure. Yeah. That's something every year when it rolls around, it kind of catches me off guard. But then definitely, feel back to that time and what was going on that day.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. You were an F-16 pilot on that day. And where were you operational?
Well, it was F-15s.
15, excuse me.
Yeah, and it's flying the Eagle out of Otis Air National Guard Base in Massachusetts.
All right.
Cape Cod.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
How long had you been doing that by that time?
Let's see, I got there in mid-99 after doing some active duty time. Yeah, so a couple of years there. And we had, we had alert commitment there at Otis where we had two jets on alert 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. So
was that called Noble Eagle back then, or was it called something else?
Yeah, that was just after 9/11. And Noble Eagle was basically the CAT missions, combat air patrol missions over.
Right. But you guys were standing alerts on September 10th, 2001?
Yeah, for years and years, 30 years, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah, so
just like NORAD stuff or?
NORAD, exactly. Okay.
All right.
Some drug interdiction stuff too, but mostly NORAD.
Okay. All right. So when you were standing those alerts, were you, how far away were you, if you will? Like the alerts I'm used to on a carrier are alert 7, you're sitting in the airplane, 15, you're in the ready room in your flight gear, 30 is you're in a flight suit, and then 60 and 120. Of course, you can't go farther than wherever you can go on the ship. But
right.
what posture would you guys stand prior to that day?
So we were what's called immediate, which would be, not in the jet, but you had to be, airborne immediately, basically.
Wow.
And typically our jets were parked across the ramp. So it was a, 2 minute car ride across the ramp and jump in the jets. And then at night we had a living facility right there attached to them. So.
All right. So you had to be relatively close.
Right.
All right. So tell us about on the morning, morning on the East Coast of 9/11, did you say earlier you had already been flying that day?
So I was going in for a regular training mission. We were doing a 4v4 similar, training mission. We had two guys on alert, obviously. And it was a beautiful day up in Cape Cod. I mean, it was the perfect day to go flying. And I was also a pilot with airlines, so I was getting ready to leave for a trip the next morning. But I remember sitting at Dunkin' Donuts, getting a coffee on the way to work and hearing that it was the UN National Day of Peace or something to that effect. And, just kind of driving into work thinking that this is like the perfect day to fly. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were going into train and, showed up a couple hours early to get the briefing boards ready and everything. And our director of operations was actually on alert that day and saw him at the desk. We typically wore some of our gear just to expedite if you were on alert. We have our G suits on in case the horn went off. But yeah, I mean, totally typical normal day of flying ahead of us is what we thought.
Yeah. Just to draw a parallel, I was in Fallon, Nevada at the time, and mm-hmm. I woke up, I think I was in the car at 6 something, so that would have been 9 something your time, and I remember hearing on the radio that an airplane had crashed into the World Trade Center. My first impression was, what an idiot. How can you not see this thing and avoid it? So at any rate, so you're probably up early, and so you go out on this flight, and I assume it's uneventful, so tell us about it.
Yeah. So, and it's funny you say that because, kind of behind the scenes, we didn't know what was going on because we were pre-flighting our jets. We briefed normally and went out to our jets, but, we had a command post right in there that controlled all the alert assets and, right in our squadron building and then an operations desk that kind of did the training day-to-day stuff. And one of our enlisted guys at the operation desk got a call from the tower at Otis saying, hey, we've got Boston Center on the line. There's something about a hijacking. And that was completely out of, the chain that it should have fallen through, to get through NORAD into the command post. And so our squadron commander, who was kind of supervising that day, the flying operation, ran into the command post. And he literally had Boston Center on one phone and NORAD on another phone. And he was kind of the go-between trying to figure out what was going on. So he called the alert guys into the command post and same kind of thing. He said, hey, we've got a confirmed hijacking, get out to the jets and just await words. And, in talking to them after the fact, they just, like you said, they thought, this was like a hijacked jet that was going to land. They were going to escort it and land it somewhere. There'd be demand
a bunch of money or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And then that'd be that. And so while we were doing our pre-flight on our jets, there were 8 of us. We were, we saw the security forces come out onto the flight line with their lights flashing. And just because we had seen it so many times, they're getting scrambled. But not really thinking a whole lot about it because it wasn't uncommon that would happen on a day-to-day basis. And So we saw them blast off, and then it was kind of out of sight, out of mind until we took off about 10 minutes later. Our training area kind of runs along Long Island south over the ocean there. And they just leave us alone out there. But we were in the training area getting ready to fight. And they said, hey, it's Boston Center. You guys need to get back home, which was really, really, I've never heard that call before. That was unusual.
Yeah.
So we called our squadron ops and they said, yeah, you gotta let's get back as soon as you can. And, meanwhile, those guys were pretty much almost to New York City, the two alert jets, when they heard, the second jet just crashed into the World Trade Center. And that's the first they knew that anything was going wrong that day, other than that they were getting scrambled to intercept the hijacked airliner.
Yeah. So let's back up a little bit, Opus. What would be an alert loadout back then for the F-15?
Yeah, so it changed. You know, I think that day we had two external tanks and probably two heat-seeking missiles and four radar missiles, but I'm not exactly sure about that. It was kind of a standard load for that kind of a mission.
And gun, I'm sure.
And guns, yeah.
And was the idea... with the NORAD frame of mind back then that it might be, I mean, what was the threat, quote unquote, prior to that day?
Yeah. So, you know, interesting, you know, there was always the, and there had been history at Otis of, you know, the Russian bombers kind of a thing, but that hadn't been for years. Mostly it was, you know, unidentified aircraft that were coming into the '80s. That needed to be identified. So,
which is usually just private pilots who screwed up their transponders.
Especially in the summertime, you know, fish spotters and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Well, excuse to go flying maybe, but.
Exactly. Right.
Okay. So the idea of airliners as a weapon probably hadn't kind of occurred
not
to you guys,
all.
Maybe? Yeah,
no.
It certainly hadn't to me at that point.
Yeah.
All right. So, sorry to interrupt the story, but all right. So they have you guys come home and. Then what?
Yeah, so, you know, just like I'm sure any fighter pilot would do, they said, stay out by your jets. We're going to, you know, get you what you need, and then we're going to launch you again. And, of course, you don't turn an F-15 in minutes, so we all ran inside the squadron to see what was going on. And but when I was getting into the building, we were watching just after that second plane had hit World Trade Center. So, you know, they typically, it would take us 2 hours to turn a jet, you know, get it back airborne, refueled and serviced and everything. And that's without adding live weapons on there. They had us turn within a half an hour at most. So it was an amazing feat that they achieved to get us back in the air. And so initially it was out of the eight that we had been on the training mission with, they had four ready and we blasted off. They cleared two up to Boston and then just to cap. And we were headed up towards Boston, got an intercept just off the coast, which turned out to be a C-130, believe it or not. That's how chaotic it was at that point. And, you know, just in a, just back up for a second, when I ran out to my jet, I had two heat-seeking missiles and a gun loaded up and, one of our intel officers met us at the jet and he said, there's eight jets airborne with bombs on board. And we've had two jets ran out of fuel and crash into the Atlantic. Of course, none of that was true, but that just goes to show you what kind of information we had when we took off. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
So we knew that, one of the jets airborne was United 93. And we originally were scrambled out to see what was going on with that jet, but it had crashed just minutes after we took off. So we never got near it. And yeah, so then after we went up over Boston, we got vectored down over Long Island, and then there was nothing there. And then they said, we'll head down over New York City, where the original two guys who had been scrambled were capping at that point.
Yeah, that's... I remember that morning I drove through the gate and it was one of those just wavy on kind of thing. And I rolled down my window and said, hey, aren't you guys elevated alert yet? Cause I think at that point they'd started to hint at the idea of terrorism. And they said, no. So then I ran into my squadron, which was Top Gun at the time, and said, hey, turn on the TV. And at that point, you know, it was such a helpless feeling. All you can do is sit and watch. And of all things, I couldn't just sit there. So I actually went into the gym and changed and got a workout. We have a little gym there, I used to. And there was a TV in there and I turned it on. And I remember watching live the second one too. And it was just this disgusting feeling, but also this helplessness. But also, as you intimated, Opus, just this uncertainty, like, what the heck is going on? Like, right. I mean, we all know now from the benefit of history and all the intel that we've gathered to know where it started and how they got into the country in the first place and the lessons and everything else. But at the time, boy, we didn't know what was what. And I'll tell you, I mean, you talked about your experiences. For us, we were pure training. I mean, I didn't even know there was live weapons in Fallon other than the ones we would drop on for air to surface. And by the end of the day, we, no kidding, had old F-18s loaded up with Sparrow and Sidewinder and guys sitting in their flight gear just because we just didn't know. Right. And so I have to think that was happening all over the country. But how long did you end up flying on that second flight? Did you refuel or did you just hang out for?
Yeah, so we actually commandeered a tanker that was leading over a flight of A-10s that were redeploying back to the States. And so the other two guys who took off with us went out and intercepted that tanker and camped that thing over Boston. Now, it just so happened that the day we were doing our training mission, we had a tanker scheduled. So we just moved him from our training area down to New York City, and we refueled probably 7 or 8 times that day. I flew for about 6 or 7 hours. Wow. And of course, obviously, most of the work was done in the first hour because everything had been ordered to land, as you know. But I think it's like you said, we didn't know what was going on. And when the first two guys were after the impact, they said, you know, basically same mission, meaning what do you want us to do? And NORAD was completely silent. So they didn't know what to do either. Yeah. And finally, the flight lead said, well, listen, we're going to set up a cap over New York City. We'll ring around it 25 miles and nothing will get inside that ring. They didn't want to get drawn off of the cap and then have somebody come from the north or something execute another attack. So
any idea how many fighter elements were airborne that day on the East Coast?
I know that we had two. We had 4 airborne over New York City.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
City, 2 over Boston. We had, eventually there were a couple over Washington, D.C., obviously, for the Pentagon, slightly after us. And then as far as the rest of the country goes, I'm not exactly sure. So, you know, and back to that mission, when we took off, obviously things had developed a little bit, but they told us, you know, hey, your mission is to intercept and identify. And, if an airliner doesn't comply, then stand by for more words. And I just remember thinking to myself, man, I know what's coming next and I do not want to have to, you know, shoot down an airliner. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And the other thing you got to remember is we were all, you know, Air National Guard. So, out of the 6 of us airborne that day, 4 were airline pilots, 2 United, 2 American. So, you know, I tell you, one of the bright spots of the day came when our squadron operations came on and said, hey, everybody in the squadron's accounted for, just because we didn't know if anybody was involved with, the hijacking or whatnot.
Yeah, because at least, 93 was out of Boston, or was there more? I don't know that.
Yeah, there were 2. So an American and a 93,
I assume, were you close enough to see the smoke from New York City? I have to think you were. I heard the astronauts could see it from outer space.
Yeah. So when we finally got down to New York City, the second building had just fallen, and the entire lower part of Manhattan was just covered in smoke. And, we kind of thought the buildings went over, right. Just go straight down. So we didn't know. That was another scary scene, because we thought 50,000 people had died. We had no idea, and that's kind of when it clicked and went, look, you're here to do a mission, and, you're not making the decision. You're executing the decision that the people on the ground, hopefully with a big picture, are making. And so, it's kind of the country's counting on you to get it done and make this stop. So it was just incredible. We worked really closely, believe it or not, with New York Approach that day, because NORAD and Giant Killer up there in the Northeast, it was hard for them to keep track of threats and non-threats. I think it was really interesting, looking back on it, working with New York Approach, who never worked with military before, and they were just calling targets out all over, New York City, New Jersey, and everything. And we basically said, listen, you guys are giving us good information, but, we need to know where the target is, maybe an altitude if you have it, and then we just need you guys to be quiet once we say, we're ready for contact. So they caught on really quickly, and it was actually really effective for having never worked with them before and them never working with us before.
Yeah.
To chase down aircraft.
Yeah. Did you end up intercepting any civilian guys that were just out, had no clue what was going on?
And also, believe it or not, lots of helicopters, military even, that were coming to sort of lend aid and possibly help evac out.
Yeah.
I don't know how effective that was, but I do remember intercepting a three ship of Chinook helicopters and then coming up on guard and saying, hey, don't shoot us down. It's like, we're here to help too, And it was just like, it was just crazy, because there was no real operational control of what was going on right then. So
when you think of the expression fog of war, is that kind of, you think about that day?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, and we're air to air, we're good. Navy, Air Force, we're good at what we do. I think it helped stabilize the situation that we kind of took control of it from the air and that we could see what was going on. Shortly after we got on CAP, we heard, hey, we're having the same issues in Washington, D.C. And it was really one of those things that, your heart started racing again. But, it was like, look, here's our responsibility. This is our AOR. It's over the World Trade Center, and they're going to have to get someone else to deal with that. We kind of had to compartmentalize that and just concentrate on what we were doing.
Yeah.
It's like, I remember that day I was intercepting. I was up over kind of the George Washington Bridge. They called out a contact that was over by JFK. So kind of southeast, couple miles. And, I'm flying over Central Park at a couple hundred feet, and I see a guy jogging. And I just remember thinking to myself, what is this guy doing jogging, when all of this is going on? But he didn't know. He didn't know what was going on. He's out for a morning jog, And I think it's such a good metaphor for that day. It's like people just didn't have a grasp, because it wasn't even within their, their ability to conceive of something like this happening, even though a few years earlier they had driven a truck underneath the World Trade Center trying to bomb.
That's right.
So
yeah, 93, I think it was.
So
I don't know about you, Opus, but you join the military, you expect that you're going to sacrifice where you want to go, where you want to live, even maybe what airplane you fly. And I talk to young people on this show about that all the time, because you may not get the airplane you want, but you try to make the most of it. And I think I was personally ready for most things, but the thought of shooting down an airliner full of people just, that was out of left field. When I started contemplating that, and I was never, of course, in a position where I was flying like you were, but you were that just, I guess my point is that much closer. Well, I mean, you're in the airplane, hey, you're all business, but you kind of alluded to it before. What was that like for you? Did you allow that to creep in a little bit?
I mean, it did, you know, I'll be completely honest with you. And, you know, I had flown combat missions before and it sounded like combat. So to juxtapose that over your city, you know, you're in the United States, it was, that was hard to deal with. But like I said, once we got down to ground zero, it had to stop. And that was, you know, part of the oath you took. You know, it's people ask me all the time, you know, looking back, what do you think about that day? Well, it was probably the worst flying day I had, but also, you know, in a way I was pretty lucky because I didn't have to, you know, because that would have obviously been a life-changing event. You know, the truth is that those terrorists, they knew what they were doing. You weren't going to save the people on those airliners, unfortunately.
That's right.
No matter what. So it became about regaining air superiority over our country and protecting the people on the ground.
Yeah. And so, I have to think, as I got to be delicate here. I mean,
yeah.
If you assume the airplane is going to crash, right, the people on board are almost a sunk cost, and I would never consider someone's life a sunk cost. But I think if you think of the analysis, you could say, okay, that's a foregone conclusion. What can I save if I keep them from striking the White House or the Capitol or whatever the other targets were for? And of course, I don't want to go into any of the, you know, we're such a divided country right now. Some people might cheer for certain parts of that, but that's not the point I want to make, of course. But if you did have to do it, I think at least for me, that's what I would have to do is, hey, look, kind of like the Flight 93 guys. Okay. They went down in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And so nobody on the ground died, but of course everybody on the airplane did, but nobody else died at the Pentagon or the Capitol or whatever. Right. So,
yeah, unfortunately they were, you know, on the front lines of the battle that day and, certainly not by choice, and they're all heroes. I mean, I got to meet many of the families just, you know, in the time after 9/11, it's tragic. It's just absolutely tragic. But, you know, for us, we didn't have a chance to let that emotion come into it at that time. It was something we all dealt with in varying degrees, certainly years after 9/11, and even today. And so, I mean, I guess that's how you process it. You know, we're trained to do a mission, and it's just, even though we weren't planning on that specific mission, we just had to kind of box it off.
Yeah. When you finally landed that afternoon, how long had you been airborne?
I think about 7 hours, 6 hours. Yeah. And
no peanut butter and jelly, right? Nothing. But
nothing.
Whatever you
keep. I mean, honestly, it seemed like an hour, you know, just because it was
so much happening.
You know, exactly. Yeah. You know, and I mean, I just, we're going back to the base, you know, requesting an altitude like you normally would do to fly back, you know, on IFR clearance. And they're like, you guys are the only ones flying.
Yeah.
Whatever you want. It's just like, wow. You know, I mean, crazy.
Did you guys man alerts through the night or the next day or anything, or a fly, I should say, alerts?
Yeah. So that changed a lot after 9/11. And then we kind of had that tiered system that you talked about. I'm sure there was some coordination, you know, Air Force, Navy, and, you know, sort of, you know, what do we have that we've done that would work in this situation? So, yeah, we definitely upped our alert commitment. We did not train for the next year. We didn't do one training mission for the next year. Our whole being was all flying combat air patrols over American cities. So, and then having that immediate response, which, you know, after 9/11, it was anything, these temporary flight restrictions were causing issues for private pilots. You'd have people pop up, similar names that, you know, on a terrorist watch list, we'd go intercept. So then it was really busy for sure. It was like,
Opus, let me ask you about November. I don't remember the exact date, but there was another airliner crash on Long Island, and it turned out to be structural / pilot induced. Do you recall that, number one? And
In fact, believe it or not, Rosie McGrady and I got scrambled on that jet. It obviously had crashed, but because they didn't know what happened at the time, they scrambled us down just to see. Of course, we only saw wreckage, but yeah, I mean, again, you're like, are you kidding me? This is going to happen.
Just barely got back.
Exactly. You know, another unfortunate case, but you know, it was fortunate that it wasn't another terrorist attack kind of situation. And I'm sure that the people on the ground, you know, were, and you know, not digging that news either.
No, I remember hearing that, thinking, oh, nuts, here we go again. And then later when you read the report of the guy using, I think, full rudder, but that was what he was taught. That was kind of crazy. But yeah, I just wondered, again, in the absence of information, people are going to fill in their own narrative. Sure. And so you guys, sounds like you blasted off and don't know. And of course, did they end up grounding or stopping or anything that day until they figured it out? Do you recall?
They did not. I do remember feeling, it wasn't apprehension, but I definitely felt way better prepared, you know, a month later when that incident happened.
Sure.
Then on 9/11, just because that was total chaos. You know, and I think, I've been fortunate again, like I said, to meet some of the people who were on the ground in the World Trade Center area that day. A person I met who's become a good friend, Gil Sanborn, was across the street when the attacks happened. And, he said that, and this is just, it's just kind of inspiring to hear, but he said that, they went from total chaos to when they saw the F-15s go over, and they just felt a total sense of, okay, well, now we've got this, you know? And so they evacuated out of the city. Like you said, on September 10th, they talked about ALERT being a mission that was going away. And obviously after September 11th, that all changed in that day.
Well, the world changed too. And I look back and I remember thinking at the time, and I don't pretend to be particularly smart. Everybody knew that the world was going to change, but just our way of life, air travel, certainly. And of course, you know, COVID, I think, is also having a similar effect now on this generation. Right. But I just knew that nothing would ever be the same. It was definitely one of those days that people who were alive when Kennedy was shot, they say they remember. People who were alive when Pearl Harbor was attacked, same thing. And for those of us who experienced this, it's one of those days you just never forget, certainly for you.
Yeah. And I think, looking back on it, and I've spoken to all kinds of different groups around the country about it. And honestly, it's the thing that resonates with me is that, never forget. I think it's important that we remember, even if it's just once a year, that this is, a turning point in our country's history for many reasons. And that, we owe it to those people who found themselves on the front lines that day, whether they were in the World Trade Center or on one of the airliners, to just pause and remember them give thanks for the lives that they had. The people in the World Trade Center, they just went to work that day. What I mean? And they didn't get home that day. And it's just something that I try to really reflect on every day. I'm feel blessed that, I'm here and have this time that they don't. So
none of us will ever forget this day. Yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.